Not far from Boston, Cape Cod is a spit of land that juts 40 miles out into the ocean. It's a famous summer playground for tourists, but there's another Cape Cod for the people who live there year-round. Among them is writer Robert Finch. For years, he's captured the magic of the Cape in essays broadcast on his local public radio station, WCAI. His subjects range from wood ducks and ocean thunderstorms to oyster fishermen and Cape Cod diners. 52 of these bite-sized essays were recently published in a collection called A Cape Cod Notebook. Steve Paulson went to meet Robert Finch near his home on the Outer Cape in the picturesque town of Wellfleet to get an insider's view of Wellfleet's distinctive ecosystem.
Everything you see here on this side of the river is part of the Cape Cod National Seashore. From the right-hand side, stretching all the way to the left, you see a line of dunes, islands, more dunes, another island, about a 7-mile stretch.
It's a windy day as Robert Finch and I stand on a country road next to the Herring River on the outskirts of Wellfleet. Every so often we have to step off the road to let a car pass by. This particular geological formation we're looking at, the string of small islands connected to the mainland, is called a tombolo, and it turns out it hasn't been here that long. When Thoreau wrote about the same spot 150 years ago, there was no tombolo. These were unconnected islands, and ships could sail right into a harbor here. It's easy to forget this landscape is constantly changing, but it's one of the things Finch likes so much about Cape Cod.
And it's beautiful. But of course, if you look out, one of the things you're going to notice is this enormous new house sitting right up on top of a dune. This one is so blatantly out of scale.
It's huge, to put it bluntly.
Enormous, it's enormous. I mean, the good effect it had is it finally got the town of Wellfleet to pass zoning laws affecting building within the National Seashore, limiting size, limiting footprint, so that a house like this will not be built again. And all I could think of, that this is such an American process. We have to have one or two disasters or catastrophes to make us act. We can't just do it in anticipation of something. We have to wait for something bad to happen, and then we'll act. So there it is. It's a monument to what we should have done years ago, but we finally did it.
Bob Finch follows in a long line of writers who've chosen Cape Cod as their subject, going back to William Bradford 400 years ago. Thoreau later became a touchstone for all writing about the Cape, and more recently, so has Annie Dillard, who still lives in Wellfleet.
I fell instantly in love with the place when I came here for the first time as a college student in the 60s. I just knew it was the place I wanted to live. It was the place I felt I should have been born. I knew I wanted to write about it. I accidentally got connected with the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History, began writing columns for them. But I'm not, strictly speaking, a nature writer.
Finch prefers to call himself an essayist who writes about sense of place. Though, as the co-editor of the Norton Book of Nature Writing, he admits he can't exactly dismiss the nature writing label. He's especially fascinated by the complex interplay between the natural world and the human world, and he's found Cape Cod to be the ideal setting for this kind of writing.
When I first got here, I remember somebody told me that there was not one square foot of Cape Cod that had not been altered by human action. Ultimately, I feel that we were formed by the natural world, not just in the obvious biological evolutionary sense, but psychically.
The wind picks up as we walk up the road to look at a dike and the opening where the Herring River pours into the marsh, another example of how people have transformed this landscape. The dike was built over 100 years ago in an effort to block the tidal flow so developers could clear this wetland. It didn't work, but the dike drastically changed the ecosystem. Now the National Seashore, along with the town of Wellfleet, wants to remove the dike to restore the original salt marsh. Finch can't really complain, as he says, who can oppose a salt marsh, but he's not altogether happy about this restoration project. Even a man-made habitat can become something unique and even quite marvelous.
It is a brackish freshwater wetland system. Actually, that kind of habitat is much rarer on the Cape than salt marsh.
Finch says this river valley has its own beauty. It's full of flowering shrubs and the best blueberries he's ever tasted. But he points out that many of these plants are what are known as invasive aliens. Finch believes not every alien species should actually be considered invasive.
That's what interests me about the whole thing, is this human concept of restoration, which is a fairly recent notion, but has gained rapid currency. Everybody's for restoration. And my question is always, restoration to what?
Bob Finch gets his hackles up when people talk about nature in absolute terms, as if all native plants are good and all alien species evil. We walk up the road to a clearing, looking for refuge away from the wind. Under a pine tree, I ask him to read one of his essays about this coastal habitat.
Crab Charity. It's not every day you get a lesson in crustaceans and charity from the same source. The other afternoon, returning from Hyannis by a back route, I came to a spot where the road crosses a tidal creek several miles inland. I got out to look around and noticed a young boy perched on some rocks where the channel comes out underneath the road. He was about 10 or 11, red-haired and freckled. He was holding a dip net with a long handle and wearing rubber boots that were filled to the brim with water. As it turned out, though, his boots were not for keeping his feet dry. "What are you fishing for?" I asked. "Crabs," he replied, not taking his eyes off the water as it swept by. "Blue crabs?" "Yep." At first I thought I'd encountered one of the last practitioners of the Cape Codder's fabled reticence, but suddenly he swooped his net down into the murky waters and came up with a small, struggling blue crab about 4 inches wide. The catch seemed to loosen his tongue. "They start to swim through here when the current starts to flow in," he informed me. "It's all muddy and crapped up when it's going out, but it starts to clear up now, and you can see them swimming along the bottom. You have to throw them back if they're less than 5 inches, or there won't be any left, but this one I'm going to keep for my science class." The boy gingerly began to transfer the crab from his net to the bucket. Not an easy feat, for the crab's temper, to use an old pun, is snappish, and its appearance is no less intimidating. Armed with two strong front claws, the crab has a shell that's drawn out into a sharp point on each side. To remove one from a net is like poking your fingers into a snapping, clacking pincushion. The purpose of his boots became apparent. "We used to catch them to sell," he went on, "but we only got 50 cents apiece for them, so I went into my own business, and I give them away to whoever comes along. You can have the next one I catch." I thought this was a refreshing use to make of a poor market, and hoped that local economic development councils would be glad to hear of this public-spirited example of free enterprise. Just then, some friends of his came canoeing through the culvert, and he went off to talk to them. I stood there, admiring his ability, his sportsmanship, and especially his eel grassroots knowledge of life in this creek. It's the kind of first-hand knowledge that comes from just messing around, and that no science class or textbook can teach. Here, I thought, begins the lifelong naturalist. Then, in the clearing water, I saw what looked like a large crab clinging to a piece of seaweed in the current. I called the boy over, and he crept swiftly down the rocks, swung his net down, and hauled up not one but two good-sized wriggling crabs. I could already taste the succulent crab meat for dinner. But the young philanthropist scrambled back up and raced over to his companions to show off his catch. Apparently, his recently formed crustacean foundation had been suddenly dissolved, and I realized that if I wanted crab charity, I'd have to begin at home.
Bob Finch suggests we go visit some clamshellers he knows, so we hop into his car and drive over to Indian Neck in Wellfleet Harbor, and then walk out onto the tidal flats. He's told me to wear sandals, where we're greeted by an army of small crabs scurrying across the mud.
These are fiddler crabs. Their distinguishing characteristic is this giant oversized claw, one claw on the male. And they're called fiddler crabs because they move the claw across the other claws if they're playing the violin. Close up, they look rather fearsome, and one of the three species here has a specific name, a pugilator. But it's all display for territory and for mates.
Further out on the mudflat, we meet Pat Woodbury, who's tending a bed of clams. He and his wife Barbara have acquired the rights to manage this particular bed of shellfish.
These are little necks. What we do is we get seed from a hatchery, and they go in these nursery trays for the summer. And then we take them out of the nursery trays, spread them in these 12 by 50 or 100 foot rows right in the sand, and then cover those with a net. And they spend 2 to 3 years under the net. At that point, they're adult size, and we harvest.
So their whole lifespan, they're just basically either in the tray over there or under the net?
Yes. The whole purpose of what we do is to protect them from predation.
So what's the art of this?
strong back, weak mind.
25 years ago, Pat and Barbara Woodbury moved to Cape Cod from Chicago. Now they're two of the Cape's most admired shellfish growers, and they sell their clams to some of the top restaurants in Boston and New York. This morning, they had a last-minute order from a local restaurant, so they're out raking for a couple of buckets of clams. The Woodburys sort out the clams into two grades of sub-legal size, which they stick back into the mud, and four grades of legal. Different restaurants want clams of various sizes.
This is probably a little neck, the lower limit of a little neck, because it's about an inch across.
Shelling is the Woodburys' livelihood, but it's also clearly a labor of love. Barbara and Pat Woodbury, like Bob Finch, are the face of the new Cape Cod, people who moved to the Cape years ago and now call it home. In some ways, it's an old story, people falling in love with a place and then leaving their own imprint. If we're lucky, their presence makes the place richer and more vital. And in the Woodbury's case, it means quite literally growing new life.
When we get these from the hatchery, there's about 150,000 seed in a 5-gallon bucket. We would stock, say, a 100-foot row with about 70 to 80,000 individuals. By the end of the 3-year growth period, that's going to represent 8,000 pounds of shellfish. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty amazing conversion.
So can you make a decent living doing this, raising clams?
Well, we've been doing it for 25 years, so, you know. Let's put it this way. Both my kids are musicians, and I've encouraged them to do that as a more steady, kind of stable means of income.
Steve Paulson produced our story about the Cape Cod town of Wellfleet. You'll find links to the Woodbury Shellfish website and to Robert Finch's Cape Cod essays on our website at ttbook.org, where you can also see photos of Steve's visit to Wellfleet.